Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Yeah, so what I want to do in these two talks, which really go together, is sort of take you on a much more particular journey into sort of the tortured Catholic scholars kind of society, and have you sort of accompany me as I've been trying to think about what it means to be a Catholic intellectual and what it might not mean, and how we live out sort of the Catholic intellectual life in the secular setting where most of us, well, I guess all of you are, probably most of you are going to continue to be also when you're done with your current studies. And the first thing I want to talk about is this: why study created things? Now, we've created things, I mean everything that's not God. So I'm going to take most of my examples from astronomy. They are actually like pretty close to also some of the examples that Aquinas gives, as you'll see. But you could, I think, just as well give this talk if you were somebody who was studying history or art or cell biology or anything else that has to do with the created order. So everything that's not God. Now, if you were to ask this question at your university to a typical sort of secular kind of audience, in some sense that would be a nonsensical question, because all there is to study are these kind of things, right? You might ask the question like, why study at all? But if you have already decided to study something good, well, then created things is what you would study. Though they would probably be a bit squishy about calling them created things, because that would start leading you towards the idea of a creator. But just the material sort of order that's around us. But as Catholics, we have something else that we can study, right? Which is God himself. If you are asking this of yourself, like why study created things, I think there's one thing that often comes to mind as a reason, which is the more sort of practical outcome that can be very good of the kind of things that we study. So sort of like good Catholic sort of practical reasons for studying science, for example. A lot of sort of biology that's going on right now has to do with medicine, right? About different ways of healing people. And this is all good. And I'm going to completely ignore that for the rest of the talk. So this is not to say that that might not be what sort of you have in mind for your studies, but I would propose to you that in addition to that, there's also just that you want to know. We talked about in the last presentation about this part of our human nature to want to know, to want to know the truth. And even if you have some practical aim in mind, as a part of a study, there's always just going to be this desire to know. So instead, what we'll be focusing on in like asking this question, why study created things, is why study created things sort of just to find out more things about them. So think more sort of Big Bang rather than sort of biomedical research, the kind of question, the sort of image to have in your back of your mind. Before going into sort of positive motivation, I think it's good to just pause and just have a little bit of intuition of why this cannot be a bad thing as a Catholic to study sort of things around us. This is something you could spend a lot of time on, but fundamentally, when we're thinking about like one of the great gifts of Christianity is this very clear distinction between the creator and radical distinction between God, the creator of all things, on the one hand, and creation on the other. And because they are so radically distinct, they can never be in competition with one another when we're trying to find out sort of knowledge or causes or powers of things. We can be quite confident that those are never going to threaten anything that we can know about God. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in the second talk. But having that, I think, sort of as provisionally accepted that it cannot be a bad thing to learn about the created, sort of created order, learn about creatures, like why should we study it in the first place? Or in other words, why not just study the highest thing? Like, why not just study God himself? especially since we just heard that, okay, you don't have to turn off your intellect. Actually, you shouldn't turn off your intellect if you are contemplating God, that there's like faith and reason that goes together. You can really, in some sense, study God. So why should we not all be theologians? And here you come to, again, sort of like this sort of more sort of personal torment, which is I've been spending the past 4 months here. It's been glorious. I've been reading more Aquinas in this 4 months than in the past sort of 10 years. And now I'm getting ready to return to sort of more fully to my day job of doing astronomy. And like, what is the good of doing that? Or how can you sort of justify for yourself, like studying these created things when you have the option to studying the creator himself? And that's where I find a lot of comfort and solace in the handout that you have all been given, which is a chapter from the other Summa by Aquinas, so the Summa Contra Gentiles, where if you look at the opening sentence, it is not just that it's good to study created things, but that meditation on the divine works, so everything created, is indeed necessary for instruction of faith in God. So I guess this is the spoiler alert that I should probably have said before I said it, but that there is a way in which studying created things and applying reason to created things that helps illuminate your faith in God. So there is another way, in some sense, of studying God is studying his creation. And I think one of the ways to get a little bit of intuition about that before we get into the specifics is even just considering how you know people naturally, how you know someone like at least a favorite author of mine, perhaps a favorite author of you, someone like J.R.R. Tolkien. Like, how would you know something about them? One of the ways you could know something or get to know something about Tolkien is, of course, to talk to him directly, if that is not an option, since he's dead and not officially a canonized saint, even though I think he probably should be, is to read a biography of him. That would be a way to get to know something about Tolkien. But another way to get to know something about Tolkien would be to read Lord of the Rings. Right? That is another way to understand something about how Tolkien is. And I think that provides a bit of an analogy, imperfect as it is, of why sort of studying creation is another way to get to know God. It is, however, just an analogy. It is an imperfect one because you might think that Tolkien, in some sense, is very present in Lord of the Rings, but he's present in a much lesser degree than God is present to the created order. When we create something and sort of like put it out there, its very existence no longer depends on us. Like, it is something that is sort of separate from us. But if we're looking at the cosmos, whether some portion of it or the cosmos as a whole, that is at every moment held in existence by God. So when we think about sort of creation, I think we often think about it as we making something, and that is certainly one way of that is reasonable to think about God creating. But the more sort of the more fundamental way in which we understand God's relationship with his creation, or like God creating, is as a kind of relationship. So that he is really giving being, is in some mysterious sense also present in his creation. And I guess that's what I had on this slide. But let's turn into some specifics that Aquinas gives of why it is good to study created things. And the first thing that Aquinas comments on is that it is a way to sort of identify, meditate upon the wisdom of God. So what Aquinas says is that for things made by art are representative of the art itself, being made in likeness to the art. Now God brought things into being by his wisdom. Wherefore, the psalm declares, you made all things in wisdom. Hence, from reflection upon God's works, we are able to infer his wisdom, since by a certain communication of his likeness, it is spread abroad in the things that he has made. when we're thinking about the wisdom, it's somehow the intelligibility, like the order of the created things that we're looking for. And this is something that can also or has been used as a way to even infer God's existence. So just the order of the cosmos as a whole, that that is something that points towards an orderer. So this is from another portion of the Summa Contradentialis, where order is used as a proof, one of the many proofs for God's existence that Aquinas presents. So he says that for when men see that things in nature run according to a definite order, and that ordering does not occur without an orderer, they perceive in most cases that there is some orderer to the things that we see. So the ordered intelligibility of the cosmos is something that should be leading people first just to realize that there is someone who has put that order into place. And then when meditating upon it, understanding something about who that order is and what his characteristics are. As scholars, and again, I would take the example of scientists of astronomy, one of our sort of primary gifts or things that we get to do is to look for this order. We cannot understand anything without there being some order to it. Obviously, like whether it's this pulpit, this room, the stars above us, we are perceiving just directly with our senses some of the order around us. But as scholars, as scientists, what we then try to do is to sort of find order that underlies it. And one example is if we try to understand our Earth as a planet, there's some things that we can just get directly through our senses. We can see that there's something solid and there's like this atmosphere above it, that there's this watery thing around it. With a little bit more sort of thinking and studying, we can figure out that it's round. That's something that people did very early on. If we start having access to things like telescopes, we can start figuring out how the Earth relates to the larger system it's in. First, the solar system, then that are stars around us. That turns out that they all have planetary systems as well. Then that all these stars are ordered in this structure we call a galaxy. And that these galaxies are then ordered in a much larger cosmic structure that all amazingly obey the same very basic laws of physics. There is like many of the sort of the most stunning pictures that you get if you go and look at something like Hubble or the new space telescope, the JWST, they are of these like larger structures of galaxies or clusters of galaxies. And I think one of the things to just like pause and think about is why do so many find these astronomical images so compelling? I mean, they are beautiful, but there are many, like one of the most common questions that astronomers get is if the colors are real in these images. And I think with that, we can get into that question in the sort of Q&A. But I think what that actually reveals is that part of what the attractiveness is of these images is not just that they're beautiful, but they're true. And that they're showing something of the intelligibility of the order and structure of the universe. But what we can do by understanding the physics that governs these galaxies and understanding how to code that into computers, we can start seeing how these galaxies fit into their larger structure of the cosmos, just as we can understand how the Earth fits into the solar system. So what I'm going to show here is like a minute long or so simulation of how the structure of the universe developed over time. Starting when this simulation was launched, we thought that this began sort of a few hundred million years after the Big Bang. I'll say the data from the new space telescope is probably pushing that back a little bit further in time. But what you see are sort of the halos of galaxies that are where matters are flowing towards gravitational potentials. And that is what's slowly building up the structure. So all of these are galaxies that are ordered in a sort of cosmic web. It's something that it's typically referred to. It's something you can start to see with telescopes, but it's really by combining this sort of deeper underlying understanding of the physics that begin to sort of represent it in these simulations. So something like our Milky Way would be like one of these sort of like little central, slightly bigger galaxies that are surrounded by these clusters of galaxies. One of the reasons that this works, that we can actually make these simulations and that they fit so well with what we observe. You see some supernovae and things going off, like you're going to wonder what the explosions are. These are very massive stars exploding. But like the reason this works and what's so amazing about these kind of simulations is that the whole visible cosmos, as far as we can tell, from the smallest microscopic scales to things that are billions of light years away, obey the same laws. This is not something that you can take for granted. Like we could have, it would be mathematically perfectly possible to have a universe where the law sort of changed slightly over time or over space. There's nothing that sort of says they have to be that way. If there's anything that science has uncovered in the past sort of hundreds of years, it is how extremely well-ordered the universe is. It is not just Aquinas that thought that this was a path towards understanding sort of God's wisdom. This is something that goes back much further than him. So if we look at some of the early Psalms, it's actually very common that you find these sort of poetical or celebrations of the order of the universe as evidence of God's existence and governance. And I think that is an important thing to keep in mind because that is something that's so often brought up to be in opposition with faith, with religious faith, that we now see that the universe is this well-ordered, which seems to have a lot of explanatory power in it. And it does, but the fact that the order is there is not explained by science. Like this, science is there to sort of uncover the order, but it cannot, by its very nature, explain why the order is there in the first place. That's something that's important to keep in mind. So I said, like, most of my examples are going to be astronomy, but I also find biology and especially sort of organs of life super fascinating. And I think the other place where we look and where the next the past 100 years has just revealed, again, this incredible order is when we look into living things. We look into what it is like that sort of sets what an organism is like and how we have this genetic code at the core of us that in addition to explaining why organisms are so well ordered also explains, I think, in a beautiful way how connected we are sort of as animals to the rest of creation. So we're thinking about something like Genesis and our bodies being sort of shaped out of the clay. I think in most modern translations, I think Thomas Aquinas uses the slightly, lower term of slime of the earth. I think is what you find in the Summa. That this is something that we really, our bodies are sort of formed out of the material order. And the ways that we are related to all other animal things, we can see that in the genetic code that's in every cell in our body. However, what I find to be one of the most beautiful expressions of the incredible order inside of organisms comes from this animation of a motor protein carrying a vesicle inside of a cell. So this is an accurate animation of what's going on inside of cells all the time. So it's like the structure is like all the way down, just as it is in some sense all the way up. It is sometimes proposed in a slightly derogatory term that what sort of contemporary scientists do or contemporary scholars is not so much sort of uncovering this sort of grand visions of wisdom, but rather sort of a puzzle, like solving little puzzles. But I actually don't think that those are that different. I mean, I think what is the attraction of solving a puzzle? It is that you sort of start seeing structures emerging over time. We do get to sort of put things in sort of piece by piece. And I actually think when I think what I do as a scientist, a lot of it is trying to solve a small portion of the puzzle trusting that then other scientists will help with other pieces, and that somehow this is all going to fit together. So if we just sum up, like, the first reason to study created things, it is to uncover the deeper order underlying the immediately obvious ones, and through that see the wisdom of God. And I think that is a very reasonable first reason. But Aquinas doesn't stop there. He thinks that there is, I said, three more reasons. And the second one is that it gives us an idea of the power of God. So he says, "For the power of the worker is necessarily understood to transcend the things made. And so it is said, if they, namely the philosophers, admired their power and effects, namely of the heavens, stars, and the elements of the world, let them understand that he that made them is mightier than they." So this is obviously very close to my heart, that Aquinas chooses to focus on sort of mostly astronomical or physical objects. I think they are the ones that sort of most immediately just seem immense and powerful to us, that we have always seen kind of small and insignificant if we compare to the stars, even before we knew what they were made of. I think, again, contemporary scholarship and science have only served to make that more impressive. So if the ancients knew that the stars were at least further away than something like Saturn, that was about how far that they for sure could tell that sort of the size of the cosmos. We now know that the cosmos is larger than tens of billions of light years. We know it's larger because we can't see the end of it. Like, the universe is continuous as far as we can see, and it's only been around for around 14 billion years. And that means that there's a limit to how far we can tell. One of the great discoveries of the past 100 years was that in addition to this universe being potentially infinite, which again, if you think about, this is already a great gift. Like, if we think that the universe could be infinite, or at least sort of at the size that would be from our point of view equivalent to infinite, and then think about who made it, we get a rather beautiful icon of sort of infinite power of God. But what was, I think, an even greater gift, even if it was not sort of a one that was meant to be, or like that was sort of purposeful, was the sort of joint discovery in the early, about 100 years ago, of that on the one hand, the galaxies looked like they're moving away from us. So this was Hubble's sort of great observation. So, parentheses, Hubble never believed that the universe was expanding, so he gets a lot of credit for something he actually didn't believe in, close parentheses. But he discovered through very careful observations, I think about this is like sort of like the very extreme, in some sense, humble kind of puzzle science of just observing galaxy after galaxy after galaxy and figuring out how fast it's moving away from us. With the more sort of visionary or theoretical discoveries of Einstein, who figured out that the way to think about space and time and gravity is about anything massive sort of warping the universe both in time and space. And this makes the whole universe sort of inherently kind of unstable. Like, you can't, like, with general relativity, it is really hard to keep the universe from not shrinking or expanding. However, Einstein, who was true to his Enlightenment inheritance, did not like the idea of a universe that was changing over time and tried his best to make stop doing that in his equations. And instead, the one who figured out, like, who put together sort of Hubble's observations of this, like, galaxies moving away, with sort of the natural form of general relativity, was a Belgian priest named Lemaître. So he's the true father of the Big Bang theory, the one who actually first figured it out. Now, in addition to then giving us the universe as sort of an icon of infinity, we suddenly also have an icon of a beginning. So if we're thinking about revealing God's power, now we have also an icon of the whole universe being caused to come into existence. There is a beautiful passage in Aquinas on why sometimes God would create the universe for the beginning in the first place. I think there are more reasons than this one, which we'll come back to, but at least one of them is that if you have a universe with a beginning, even an apparent beginning, which the Big Bang is, it is not direct evidence of the sort of creation out of nothing that we believe in. But it is a beautiful, I think a much more beautiful image of it than we can ever have conceived of. If you have this apparent beginning or beginning of the universe, it becomes much harder to ignore the contingency of the universe. Even if we had a universe that was infinite in time, that would still be a contingent being that would require a sort of an explanatory cause. But the way our minds work, we're creatures in time. It is just harder to ignore that fact if we have this evidence of a beginning. So I think it's, in addition to that, it's a great gift sort of faith that we know that the universe has a beginning, that God created in time. I think it's a great gift of modern science to actually give us an image of what that looks like. One of my sort of favorite meditations is to try to, in some sense, pull the whole universe into my mind. And by the way, I guess another parenthesis, it's amazing. Like the kind of intellects that we have been gifted with, where we can, and this is some limited sense, think about the cosmos as a whole, is a beautiful thing that also should not be taken for granted. So you try to picture this whole cosmos that sort of comes into existence, and it's like vastly larger than anything that we typically see. And then you realize that the creator of that stepped into time as an embryo and as a baby. I mean, I think that is, if we're thinking about why study created things, that for me is one of the most beautiful outcomes. You also see the power when you look again at microscopic things. I said I think that the theories about origins of life are fascinating. We don't yet know how the origins of life happen, which means that we also can't be certain that it happened naturally. I think there's good sort of theological reasons to think that it happened through secondary causes. That seems to be that God's the way that God prefers to make things make new things in the cosmos. But whether or not this is a completely natural event, the fact that sort of molecules and atoms have the power to constitute organisms and living things, whether they did it from scratch or they required some sort of initial genetic code to do it. But there's like just the power sort of endowed in physical things in this universe is amazing. And again, I'm taking the step back and thinking about, okay, the power that powers sort of those powers must be all that much greater. So second reason to study created things is to discern their powers and then to realize the infinite being that powers. Third reason. For whatever goodness and perfection is distributed to the various creatures in partial or particular measure is united together in him universally. If therefore the goodness, beauty, and delightfulness of creatures are so alluring to the minds of men, the fountainhead of God's own goodness compared with the rivulets of goodness found in creatures. I love that. The sort of rivulets of goodness is such a beautiful expression. Will draw the enkindled minds of men wholly to itself. So far we've talked sort of about the intellectual portion of it. This is where we start getting into the will and sort of the enkindling of love for God's goodness. This is, I think, beautifully expressed in Aquinas. As we were in adoration yesterday, I was looking through some of the texts that were sort of accessible to me. And I came across, I think is another beautiful little snippet from St. Leo the Great that is saying something similar. which is that nature itself is a lesson for all the faithful in the worship of God. The heavens, the sea, and all that is in them bear witness to the goodness and omnipotence of their Creator. And the marvelous beauty of the elements as they obey him demands from the intelligent creation a fitting expression of gratitude. That last portion, the gratitude part, is something that we're definitely going to come back to in a few hours when we talk about sort of the intellectual life, that is, in some sense, the suitable posture of anyone who's meditating or pondering upon the created order. And I mean, I think the beauty of the universe is just so obvious. But it is the total eclipse, the rainbow, or in this case, pillars of creation, which, again, another parenthesis, the fact that even in sort of a secular setting, when you see something as stunning like this, people sort of naturally gravitate towards your spiritual names, I think is something that should give you an idea about that the secular society is not as secular as it always claims to be. Both of these images are images of stars and planets forming. In addition to galaxies, they tend to produce the most stunning pictures. And I think there's actually a beautiful, in some sense, tension between those kinds of those two types of beauties. So galaxies are these very stable, well-ordered structures, and there's sort of a beauty in those. They're just things that just connects with our minds. The reason that these, I think, are so beautiful is that they're very dynamic and changing. And I think that is the tension where a lot of scientists and scholars find themselves, that you're both trying to find those sort of stable structures and sort of go as deep as you can in terms of the order, but then also trying to understand that sort of era of time, so where does things come from? And this will speak to the second one. Which brings me to another reason of why I think pondering something like the Big Bang is also shows the goodness of God and why we should be enkindled with love to him. So I said the Big Bang theory. So this is the theory of that if you go back in time, the universe will be more and more dense, more and more hot, up to a point where sort of our physical understanding just disintegrates. We get to a point where our laws no longer work. And out of this extremely hot and dense state, the whole universe began to expand into the kind of universe we know today, with new structures and things emerging over time. So you didn't have stars at the beginning, right? They came into existence at some point, and sometimes later galaxies, planets, and so on. And I would say another reason why you would want to have why God gave us a universe with a beginning is that we get this, a cosmic story. Like it's not like the cosmos as a whole becomes a narrative, becomes a story, which again should turn our minds towards the idea of an author, of a narrator. And that is another reason, like another way that we see God's goodness and God's love. This is in contrast with some sort of contemporary ideas that science having revealed sort of the vastness of the universe as well as the beginning of it, that is in conflict with the Christian narrative. And I think it's just important to keep in mind that the universe has always seemed sort of too big for us. If you go back to the psalmist, you know, when I see your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and stars that you set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you care for him? That we always seem tiny compared to the cosmos as a whole. But again, the amazing thing is the next line, which is that yet you have made him little less than a god, crowned him with glory and honor. And I think it's bringing those two into conversation with one another that really should enkindle this love for God's goodness. So these three things, I think in some sense, all make sense. I mean, when I first saw them, they were like, this gels with what I have seen before. It's expressed more clearly and more beautifully. But these things all sort of make sense. However, I think is the most beautiful portion of this chapter is the last rather small paragraph, which talks about how studying creation endows men with a certain likeness to God's perfection. So we talked a bit about divinization in the previous talk. And here it says that by knowing himself, God beholds all other things in himself. Since then, the Christian faith teaches man principally about God and makes him know creatures by the light of divine revelation. There arises in man a certain likeness of God's wisdom. So it is said, but we all, beholding the glory of the Lord with open face, are transformed into the same image. So this is a somewhat more like mysterious passage in the sense that, so I'm not going to pretend to try to interpret exactly what Thomas is saying, and instead we're going to be a bit of a riff on it. But I think what it got me to see is that if we study creation, we try to put ourselves looking at creation, contemplating creation, the way that God does, it's not so much that we are now looking at creation to learn things about God, but instead we're trying to look at creation with God. And that, I think, is a sort of a deeply sort of mysterious and beautiful thing. So it's not just by studying God himself that we are sort of divinized, but also is by studying his works, if we're doing it with the sort of mindset that this is all created by God. It is ordered according to his wisdom. It is empowered with his power. And it is showing the goodness that should elicit this love of us. So the sort of final reason to study created things is that a proper contemplation, a contemplation in the light of that God has created all things, is divinizing. It allows us to sort of to step in some mystical sense, into the mind of God. That doesn't mean, of course, that that's where we should stop, or that that's maybe it's even the most sort of efficient way towards a divinizing. At the end of the day, their most important truths are still the revealed truths, the things that is beyond our reason. I mean, something we talked about already, that the reason that we need faith to understand sort of the inner nature of God is that it is something that is beyond our natural capabilities. The way that I like to imagine trying to step in to this sort of divine economy is to picture myself sort of sneaking in between the Son and the Father, so the Holy Spirit cannot help but to go straight through me. So, and I think that is when we're trying to think about both how sort of studying created things can help us to understand God's wisdom, it is always ultimately to lead us into connection with the Trinity himself. And I think I will stop there and then continue in a few hours.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.